I found a few really interesting pieces here in the Yalkut Biurim.
The work they did here, it's
incredible.
Amazing.
On the Agadita that we've been learning. First of all, the piece that I want to study with you now, and almost all the pieces that I'm going to study with you, are diyukim, in an extra word in the Gemara, and building castles on an extra word. So on Daf Tesvav Amud Beis, we have a statement of Rabbi Lozov, Rabbi Chanina, in the name of Rabbi Chanina, based on a pasuk in Yeshaya, which he tackles and dissects into its various component parts. And one part of it is Liyoshev Al Mishpat. This pasuk is lauding and praising the tzaddikim. And he says, who's the Yoshev Al Mishpat that's being praised here in this pasuk? Zedayan Hadon Din Emes La'amita. And his question is, why couldn't he drop the last word? If he just would have said, Zeh Hadon Din Emes, that's good. Why does he need Le'amito? What's the extra emphasis here on La'amito? Now, Tosis says that Don Din Emes means Lafuke, to exclude the case of what's called a Din Maruma.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about a Din Maruma. The Dayan himself knows that the witnesses are perjuring themselves, but he can't prove it. He cannot demonstrate their amos. And the halacha is, you're not allowed to be Don such a Din. And this is the Gemara Masechta Shavuos on Daf Lamed Amud Beis. Minayin L'dayin Sheyodea B'din Shu Maruma. He absolutely knows. He's got this strong, very strong positive intuition, and he's certain that these Edim are in a collusion here and they're perjuring themselves. Minayin Shelo Yomar. Wow, that's a coffee for Og Melech HaBosh. You need teeth that are 60 amas long for that. Shelo Yomar HaEidim MeEidim. Maybe the Dayan is going to say the following: these witnesses are testifying. I can't prove that they're lying. Achat Chenu, I'll deliver the verdict based on these Edim. Via Kolar Toli B'Tzavrei HaEidim. The Edim are going to be guilty, not me. Why? Because I did whatever I had to do as a judge. The objective facts on the ground indicate that so-and-so is guilty as accused. The Edim are testifying. I have no way of proving objectively that the Edim are falsifying their testimony. Let them go to, you know, the other place. I don't mean heaven. You know, let them fry. What do I care? I'm doing whatever I have to do. Talmud Lomar Midvar Sheker Tirchak. So the Gemara is a special diuk, a special ribuy in the pasuk Midvar Sheker Tirchak. Stay far away from Sheker. Don't get involved. Just be misalik yourself from the din. So that's don din emes, meaning if you know that the din is false, don't judge such a din. It's only after you're absolutely sure that the Edim are testifying in a very true way, then you can issue your verdict. Well, now, what is the extra word la'mito? That's what our question was. It says, don din emes la'mito. So the Beis Yosef in Choshen Mishpat, at the very beginning of Choshen Mishpat, the Lords of Eidus, he adds the following. That according to Tosfos, the word la'mito is giving an extra warning to the Dayan. Why? Let's say the Dayan has a negiyah be'edus. Let's say he's got a very warm friendship with the toveya, or whatever the case may be, right, the plaintiff, whatever the case might be, but he's got an emotional investment here. Now, he was choker the edim, and he's absolutely convinced that the din is emes. But the only problem is that when he issues his verdict, there's an admixture here from an emotional point of view. I'm not talking about the horah per se. The horah per se is a din emes. But what's lamito? There's a little bit less than the total lamito of what a dayan should have in mind and what motivates him and why he hands down his verdict in the verdict itself. In other words, not the verdict. I shouldn't emphasize the verdict. The verdict, as we call it, cheftish al ra, is perfectly emes. But in terms of the subjective psychological motivation here, the Dayan, is absolutely thrilled that this din emes tips the scale in favor of his best friend or against his worst enemy. So he's got a negiya here. And that's not la'amito. What he has to do is he has to guarantee himself that there's no admixture here of his own personal motivation. Because the purpose of a psak din is not just for the amitus of Torah, that's for sure, but also for the purpose of the dayan being totally objective, totally disconnected. He doesn't have any benefit whatsoever from the din. And he quotes here the Ben Ish Chai, who says that if the dayan is machaven lahana'aso, if he also gets benefit and pleasure and kickback here because his oev won the case, then even though he hasn't violated din emes, the din is a din emes because he's absolutely convinced that the din is an emes, but he's not lishma. There's an element here of lishma that's lacking. And if I were to summarize this whole interpretation based on, it's a combination of the Sfasemis and the Ben Ish Chai, I would say that the extra word lamito has nothing to do with the din per se, the horah, because that verdict is absolutely a din emes, there's no question about it. But it's a message to the dayan himself about how he should conduct himself in din. And he has to guarantee, if he wants the din to be a great mitzvah of L'shem Shamayim, that he's participating in this glorious, almost divine effort of justice, that he's doing it purely for the sake of heaven, because Hashem commanded him, and not to get any benefit from the din. However, the Maharal Prague offers another interpretation as to what La'amito is coming. He says, La'fuki, it's to exclude the situation called Shuda de Daini. Now, Shuda de Daini is a sugi in two places, in Bava Metzia and elsewhere, in the Bavis, which means that there are two Bali Dinim, there's a defendant and a plaintiff. Each one takes a shtar. I'm sorry. There are two Bali Dinim. Each one is claiming ownership on a piece of property. And each one has a shtar. Each shtar says that the former owner, what's called the marakama, sold him the field. And they both have valid claims. There's no way of figuring who's got the better claim because each one has a shtar. And this is based, if I remember correctly, on the principle Ein Kosvin Shos. The exact hour is not included in the shtar, only the date. And they both have the same date. So in such a case, there's something called a shuda de daini, which means that the dayan tries to do the best he can and work out some sort of a compromise. Rashi interprets that shuda de daini means hadayanun bochanim lemi hoisa daito shel hanosein krovi yoser. If the person, let's say, gave a gift, the owner, the marakam, which of these two claimants would more likely be the one that he feels for, and he sold him the field, and based on that he makes a shuda de daini. So getting back to the Maharal, this concept of a shuda de daini is based on machshav, is based on an evaluation of the daini. It's not really emes. There's nothing sheker about it, because again, the dayan did his best that he can in the case where there's absolutely indeterminable evidence here. You cannot determine who's right. But even though it's a din emes, but nevertheless, shuda is not considered emes le'amito. Why isn't it emes le'amito? Because he needs his own shikul hadas. There's no objective evidence here to issue the verdict. And therefore, what the dayan should try as best as he can to do is to be dan a din emes le'amito, meaning an objective truth with absolute evidence, without entering into the picture his own das, his own shikul hadas, which is called shuda de daini. Again, b'les breira, if it's impossible, like we mentioned the sugya bav metzia, there's no other way out, then shuda de daini. But l'chatchila, if all things are ideal, it should be a din emes l'amito. Then the Maharal continues and he says, oh, alternatively, im don es hadin al pi shikul hadas kagon, שחולקו שני תנועים ושני אמוראים בעניין מסוי, וסוגיס השבת מסוימס כאחד מהם, שהדין הוא הלוכה כמוסו. We have a rule that in a machlokes, we look at the sugya, and if there is an inclination in favor of one of the two opinions, that's how we're going to pask it. That's not called a din emes la mito. Again, it's emes, but it's not la mito. The dayan himself really doesn't know for sure. He's not convinced that the din is achen kein, that that's really the din. He's only pasking it because the chachamim gave him a certain klal. And he's relying on that principle that if you have a sugya and the sugya indicates or is inclined towards one of the two opinions, that's the way we're going to pass him. But he's not really sure of himself. He doesn't know, based on his own analysis, that that's really what the psak is. And the reason why I'm very excited about this maral is because it indicates that a psak has to be original. It has to be the Dayan's own thinking. It's not that he's controlled by certain rigorous and mechanical rules that tell him exactly which button to press. It's not a matter of pressing the right button on the computer. It's a matter of thinking, of analyzing, of coming up with what you believe is the din emes. So I don't know, honestly, if the Maral Miprag is a practical, is implying something practical here. What happens if the Dayan has no recourse, he doesn't come up with his own chidushim, but he thinks that he's got a paskin based on these klolim, on the rules of psak. Is the maral discouraging him from handing down a judgment? I don't know, but he's saying that in the ideal form it should be a din emes la mito, that you are absolutely convinced as a dayan that that's what the din is. Now he quotes a third pshat, because we already had the Sfasemis and the Ben Yoda. And they were talking about Lishma, having it in mind for not for the sake of any Hanah, any benefit. Then we had the second Pshat, the Maral Miprag, to try to avoid Shuda Dedaini, or to avoid relying on technical klolim, but to really come up with your own understanding of the Psak, of what the halacha should be. Now we have another Pshat. Yesh Makom L'dayin L'mnoa Atzmo Miladun B'tayna. He says that who wants to get involved in judgment? It's really a hassle, because you're going to issue a verdict. You're not, you're really exposing yourself to the anger and the hatred of the one you pasken against him. Ma'alivul etzarazu. So a dayan says the following: you know what? There are greater chachamim than I am. Why should I take the mantle of judgment upon myself? And the final conclusion, if we universalize this kind of an attitude, is Ein lecha adam shizdakik l'din. A person will say, I'm afraid to get involved in judgment. I'm afraid of making an error. I'm afraid that people will take revenge against me. There are other greats who are better than me and more fit for the job. Is lekach omru lamito. What is lamito? Ein lecha ela emes shalcha. It's your emes. That's what you should do. You don't have to worry about Midvar Sheker Tirchak if you're absolutely honest and dedicated to truth. You don't have to be concerned with the possibility that someone, on the other side of the street is a bigger gadol than you are and he's a greater chacham. No. In Be'enav Hu Din Emes, if in your eyes this is a true judgment and you did all your work and you put in all your effort, Ein Lo Lochosh. And he quotes here Gemara in Sanhedrin Davov and Al Shem Yomer Adayin Mal Livet Tzar Hazeh. What do I need with this whole tzara of getting involved in judgment? Maybe I'll hand down the wrong verdict and then I'll suffer punishment. Talmud Lomar Imochem B'dvar Mishpat. The Torah went out of its way to add the word Imochem. Ein Lecha L'Dayin Elamasha Ein Avros. The Dayin should paskin based on what he knows. Let's just see if we can add one more paragraph before the Chevra come in for the official Shir on Daf Tes Vav Amud Beis. Another diuk in the Gemara of Rabbi Eliezer is that Rabbi Eliezer, in the name of Rabbi Chanina, in this whole train of statements, he says that Meshive Milchama, that in this pasuk, in Yeshaya that he's darshini, it says Meshive Milchama. Meshive means to go back and sort of hit back again. Like let's say you attack me, so I'm on the defensive. That's called meshivi. I'll give you back over the head, right? I attack you. And Rabbi Eliezer says that that's a reference to Talmidei Chachamim, shenosim v'nosim v'melchamto shel Torah. That when they get to the Beis Medrash, they're fighting with each other. What is the meshive melchama? Usually, when you set up a battle and you plan a strategy, that's called orche melchama, with an ayin, orche melchama, not meshive melchama. Why does it describe the Talmidei Chachamim as orche melchama? Why doesn't the Gemara describe the Talmidei Chachamim as orche melchama, but instead meshive melchama? And quoting the Mishnah Rishona, which is a super commentary on Mishnayos, in this case in Peah, he says the following. This debate that's going on today in the Beis Medrash, this Milchama, is an old, old Milchama. B'doros HaKodmin, in early generations, Kfar Milchamu HaChachamim, they already fought this out with Darkei HaTorah, V'Limuda, what conclusions, Kigod, Beisil, Beit Shammai, these are ancient machlokas. But yet, the Milchama keeps going on. Why does the Milchama keep going on? At one point, we pass in Halacha Kibesil. At that point, Shokta Milchama. It seems that the Milchama was quieted down. There's no longer a battlefield. But, Bidoros Acharkach, they argue about Basil. What did Basil have in mind? And therefore, Heshivu Milchama Lumkoma. The word Meshive Milchama means they bring it back again. They resurrect the old Milchama and Adam dead. In Kavanas Basil, Hayatach Vakach, Oshe Kavanas Oysa Acheres, Vyesh Nafkivino Lalocha. Ekev haMachlokes Nimso Shechachomim Elu, the contemporary scholars Heishivu Es Hamilchama Sheshakta Kfar Ba'avar. They bring back the old Milchama. V'chein. Now he goes on to the next generation. Lasha Shakta Gamilchama Zu. The second Machlokes became quieted down, and we accepted one opinion. Bochachom B'doras Achronim Upilpul B'Divrei Hachronim Heishivu Es Milchamta Lekom. Again, they have a different debate. And this is an ongoing, continuous process, b'chol adoros, in all generations. Therefore, the Talmidei Chachamim called Meshive Milchama, lo Orchel, the Arichas Milchama that was in the Doros Rishonim, that goes back to Beisil Beit Shammai. But what we're up to is Meshive Milchama, they bring back the Milchama. Absolutely stunning, stunning issue. Okay, now Rabosai, we're on Daf Tesvav Amud Beis. And we're up to Vayisaper Lahem Haman. If you count up from the bottom of the page, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 lines up from the bottom. Vayisaper Lahem Haman is Kvod Ashro Verov Bono. Now, I have to admit that this I got into is a little bit strange to my ears. The Gemara is going to have many, many different opinions about this pasuk for Rov Bonov. How many Kama Rov Bonov? How many children did he have? The Megillah only mentions 10 of them. They were all hung up on the tree, but it doesn't tell you who this Rov Bonov is. Amar Rav Shloshim. Rav says that he had 30 sons. So again, in the Megillah itself, only 10 are mentioned, and they're even mentioned by name. But apparently, 10 sons was quite common in those days. I mean, I don't think it's so common anymore. But anyway, what's he bragging about? Vayisapelem Haman, he's boasting about Rov Bonov. You know, how many children do he have? He's telling his beloved people and his disciples, his followers, that he had many, many children. So the Gemara thinks he had much more than just the 10 that are mentioned in the Megillah. So the first number is 30. And now the Gemara is going to break down this 30 into three groups of 10 each. But before we get to that, I'll just mention to you the Marsha says that since the Torah doesn't tell us exactly how many Banim Haman has beyond the Asara, and this pasuk seems Rov Banim to go beyond the Asara, so let's understand that there was another 10. Okay, but the Torah doesn't tell us if the other 10 died, or maybe they were hungry, they were poor. So let's say that there were another 10 that died, and then there were another 10 that were hungry and poor. So we have three categories of Bnei Haman. Each one is comprised of 10 members. The first group is Asara Mesu, 10 who just simply died. They died of natural causes. Asara Nitlu. Then we have the 10 that were killed by decision of the king. And then we have Asara, we have another 10, Machazrim Al Hapsachim. These are the 10 starving sons that are absolutely poor. And again, it shouldn't shock us that the children of Haman would be poor, because Haman himself was an Eved. Rabbanan Amri, Rabbanan say that Osan Shemachazrim Al Hapsachim Shivim Havya. So in addition to the first set of two sets of 10 each, 10 that died a natural death, 10 that were hung up on the tree, the other group of those who were very poor and had to knock on doors and panhandle, they were shivim, they were as much as 70. Now I'm wondering if Zeresh had all these children, or maybe Haman was married to many different wives.
Very likely.
It doesn't seem that Zeresh would have had, we're up to already 90 sons. You know, it doesn't say how many daughters they had.
The doctor speaking, so just...
Yeah, that's right. Now, how do we come up with the name, the number 7? I mean, we said there's a third group of starving children, but, you know, we still thought it was 10. Now it jacked up to 70. The Siv, and now the Gemara quotes a pasuk in Sefer Shmuel, Sveim Balachem Niskar Shivim, I'm sorry. Oh, you read it Sveim, sorry, and you're going to interpret it as Shivim. So Sveim Balachem Niskaru. Niskaru means they hire themselves out for a loaf of bread. And it says Sveim, that they are absolutely satiated. No, if they're absolutely satiated, so how could the pasuk then say that they hire themselves out to make a couple of bucks, a couple of shekels to buy a piece of bread? And therefore, it must be al tikri sveim el shivim. Don't read it as sveim, but read it as shivim. And who are these 70 paupers that are indicated in the pasuk? These are the 70 sons of Haman that were panhandling in order to make money to buy a piece of bread. Rami bar Abba Amar, Kulan, all of them, Masayim Ushmona Havu. So we're going up from, I think the number was, it was what, 70, 80, 90? We had 90 already. Now we're up to 280.
It could be that these would also include grandchildren. I wonder if you could define sons as including grandchildren.
208.
I don't know.
Masayim Ushmona is 208. No?
Yeah. What did I say, 280? I meant to say 208. Shenemar, and now we get to a gematria, Verov Bonov. So let's see the gematria of Verov. Right, Resh Kufresh is 200, and 6 and 2 is 8, 208.
No, 204. Verov is 214.
Well, he has Verov without a Vav. Right? Okay. So you have one Vav and the base, that's 8, and then Resh is 208. So the Gemara asks, wait a minute, Verov, the gematria, Masayim Var Beser Hava, Omer Rabbi Nachman Bar Yitzchak, Verov Ksiv. Without the book.
You're moving ahead of us.
Balayla hu nadda shnas hamelech. Ah, now the excitement starts, right? What's going on? Who is this king that can't sleep at night? Amar ab tanchum nadda shnas malko shel olam. And the marshayetz kadesh lo shia es Yisrael. That the Malko Shel Olam, it was the Ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save Klal Yisrael, says the Pasuk in Tehillim, Vayiketz Ki Yishan Hashem, Rashi quotes this Pasuk, that someone who's sleeping has to wake up, Mishnaso, Kidei Linkom Es Nikmaso, this is the Nekom of Hashem against the enemies of God. And this Rashi, quoting the Pasuk in Tehillim, seems to indicate, and I think we've spoken about this before, that the enemies of the Jewish people are in fact the enemies of God Himself. That's called Harabas Rivenu, the bracha that we recite after the Megillah. Rabbanan Amri, Nadadu Elyonim, Nadadu Tachtonim. He's talking about the celestial spheres above, the Malachim, that live in the Olam HaElyon, in the higher spheres. And they woke up the malachim that are down here. And what does that mean? So Rashi quotes his Rebbe here, who says that the tachtonim here is not a reference to more malachim who are down here on earth, because the malachim up in heaven can come down on earth. They don't need additional help from malachim here, but rather it's a reference to the tachtonim, meaning to the lower people, in this case the Achashverosh. And the Elyonim go ahead and they wake up Achashverosh from his sleep. Hivilu, that's the word that that Rashi uses. Hivilu, they mamish shake him up.
This has actually a comment that I thought was interesting. It's attributed to the Yalkut, and it says that does Akharis Baruch Hu sleep? Rather, when Israel sins, he makes himself as if he is asleep.
So. Interesting. So again, the malachim upstairs are disturbing Achashverosh's sleep during the entire course of the night. And Rashi says, in the name of his Rebbe, that what were they saying to him? What were they whispering to him in this very unrestful night? Kafui tova, you're an ingrate. Shalem tmura, give a what's due, some sort of reward, some sort of reimbursement. Lebisha asalcha tova. So the whole story here about Achashverosh having a sleepless night, restless night, is about giving someone payment or a favor because he did you a favor. And that's what this whole sugya we're about to embark upon is going to involve us in this question of why Achashverosh was so concerned about paying back someone who did him a favor. What was he so nervous about? Rav Amar, Shnas HaMelech Achashverosh Mamish, the sleep of Achashverosh was disturbed. Why? Nafale Milsa B'dayte, he had an idea that kept popping up in his heart. Amar, what's going on here? My dekaman, what's going on in front of our eyes? Dizminte Esther lohaman, that Esther has invited Haman to come to this very intimate banquet. We've never seen such a thing. This is really a chidush. Dilma, perhaps, Eitza koshakli ilove, Dahu Gavra Lemiktali. Now, who Gavra is Achashverosh talking about himself in third person? He says, perhaps Esther and Haman are plotting to kill me. And Haman would be a perfect person, you know, to want to kill the king for many different reasons.
It's funny, we just went through all the reasons why she might have invited Haman, and this wasn't one of them.
Right, this is only Achashverosh's phobia.
But if it inspired him to be paranoid, that would have been a good reason also to invite him. This is the one reason that wasn't in that law.
Oh, you think that it would be good for Esther for him to be paranoid?
Yeah, just like she was saying, remember she wanted, one of the reasons was for him to be paranoid that she was having an affair with Haman.
That's a little bit different, I think. There, the affair with Haman is just to get Haman killed.
Right, and to get, but this would also get Haman killed.
It would get her killed, too, though.
She also said that the other one, too, so...
So Nachmal, Eric, if you don't mind, so what's... Does your sense end with a question mark, or...?
It's a question mark.
So ask your question.
Why we actually have, you know, the Gemara telling us what, you know, one thing he might have been thinking, and it actually would have been a very good reason for us to invite Haman, and we have this whole list of reasons why she invited Haman, and it's I just find it interesting that this wasn't in the list, and I'm wondering why that wasn't one of the reasons listed, why it didn't cite this.
I would say the following. Again, in this phobia of Achashverosh, I don't think the Gemara is implying that he's going to put Esther and Haman to death. I don't think that's what the Gemara has in mind. I think what the Gemara is trying to understand is what disturbed his sleep. And what he's trying to do is, I think, Ahasuerus is trying to protect himself.
Right, yeah, no.
I don't know. I mean, you're taking it a step further. Maybe you're right.
It's more of a comment than I, you know, I'm not questioning.
Right, no. I'm just thinking that I don't...
Yeah.
I don't think that Esther would have expected that because of this phobia,
he would have
put them to death. That's going a bit too far. I don't know. Maybe you're right.
It's interesting though, because according to this, because she invited Haman, this is one of the events that, you know, this him remembering Mordechai and then the whole thing with
correct. Haman. That's what we're about to learn about.
Whole
is remembering
chain
Mordechai.
Of events, but
right.
it's.
But I don't think Esther had that in mind. You know, I think what we're doing now is. The Gemara is analyzing like the psyche of Ahasuerus.
And the other thing to learn is we you know, no matter how much we plan or how we think we have an idea as to how what we're doing with our plans, it can take a whole nother path that, you know, if Akash Baruch would want something to happen, because this wasn't the intent, and yet this is part of the chain of events that led to Haman's downfall.
This wasn't the intent of Esther.
Of Esther, but
okay, so the first thought that he has is that maybe there's a plot to kill the king. Hadar Omar, so now he gets to the second thought. And he says, you know what? I don't think anyone's plotting to kill me, because Ihachi, if in fact they're plotting to kill me, Lohavi Gavra Derochim Li Dahavi Modali, how could it be possible that no one tipped me off? One of my friends, the Rochemli, who has a love for me, should have somehow notified me. And he's asking a rhetorical question. In other words, there's no indication here, there's no hint that they are plotting to kill me. Now we get to his third machshav. Hadar Omar, could be in between each machshav, he fell asleep for a few minutes. He said, no, let me go back to my original machshava. Dilma Ika Inishti Ovid Bitivusa Velo Parati. Maybe the reason why no one is coming to support me and to tip me off about the lurking danger is because there's some person that did me a good deed and I didn't pay him up. And therefore nobody thinks it's worth helping this king. He's not loyal to his friends. Maybe that's why nobody tipped me off. Nobody told me that I should be afraid of this rebellion, of this plotted murder. Miyad, immediately, Vayomer, he declares Lahavi as Sefer Zichronos Divrei Hayomim. Now we're going to have a long discussion here about the double language here. About number one, it's called Sefer Zichronos, and number two, it's called Divrei Hayomim. But basically what's going on a simple level is that Ahasuerus wants to go through the history, the records, and see if there is someone who did him a favor and he never paid it up, and that's going to be Mordechai. Then it says, Vayu Nikra'im. And the Gemara is not happy with this syntax. It shouldn't have said, Vayu Nikra'im, they were read, but rather it should have said Vayu Korim, and they went ahead and they read it. In other words, there was a Masharis, there was somebody whose job it was, he got a salary for that in the king's palace, he would read from the Sefer HaZichronos. So what does it mean Vayu Nikroim? It should have said, and he read it. Molamich Nikroim Me Aleihem. Now at this point I have to turn to you gentlemen to tell me what this means. Is there anything there in the art scroll? Because what happened? You know, I remember when my brother-in-law got married about 45 years ago, and I remember there was a piano that played by itself. This is 45 years ago. Today, probably you could have a whole symphony orchestra playing by itself. You know, we have the technology. What is the significance here? I mean, there was actually a miracle here. The voice came out of the Sefer HaZichronos. Is that what's going on?
This is saying that and it's the Targum Shane, I think.
Yeah, okay.
The scribe charged with reading the royal records didn't want to read the section concerning Mordechai.
Well, that we're going to get to in a minute.
And so he deliberately turned the pages to avoid the section, but Akash Baruch Hu turned the pages back and the words were read of they were read of themselves. Yeah, that's the
some voice came out.
Some kind of voice came and read it.
I don't know. What can I do? This agarit is a little bit tough for me. Anyway, let's say my mate kosu.
What I don't understand is the pshat is fairly simple because the line before refers to the divrei hayamim being broad. So it would is a simple pshat that it makes sense then that the next line would refer therefore to the divrei hayamim being read. Like them being read.
Yeah, but it's about the same language as nikra.
I don't think so. You
nikra,
bring the
nikra means by itself. No,
right. You bring the safe and then you read it. You read from it. All right, let's go on. I don't want to waste that time on this. Now the Gemara's got another deal. It shouldn't have said kasuv, which seems to imply that immediately now, just recently, it was written. It should have said kasav. Kasav is a word that's appropriate for Rashi says yomim lefnei yomim rabim. So kasav means it was written many, many years ago, and kasuv means it was written right now. Kasav means that melamed, and here we turn to Tezayin Amud Aleph, Shimshai, that was the name of Shimshai, was the name of the official scribe, the Sofer HaMelech, who, as it turns out, and this is based on Rashi and various Midrashim and Pesukim in Tanakh, he was one of the sons of Haman. He was an anti-Semite. He was the Sofer already of Achashverosh's predecessors, of Koresh. He already was the one who forced Koresh, or I should say forced, but he set the motion and the mood in which Koresh decided to terminate, to take a halt in the building of the Beis HaMikdash, because this was the person recorded in Sefer Ezra as the one who wrote Sitna. Sitna means he wrote, you know, bad, toxic words against the building of the Beis HaMikdash, how dangerous it would be. We cannot allow this to go on. And as a result of his Sitna, of his antagonistic writings, of letters that circulated throughout the Malchus, Koresh decided to halt the building of the Beis HaMikdash at the beginning of the Malchus Achashverosh. And a second time around, which is more recently, he again wrote Sitna against the Binyan Bayis, also recorded in Sefer Ezra. And according to the Seder Olam, which is a historical, reliable book, it says that the Bnei Haman were those who wrote the Sitna. And Rabos, if you're ever interested, again, it would take us almost a full hour, but the Pachad Yitzchak has an entire piece here about the combination of Haman and Achashverosh in terms of this Divrei Sitna. I'm just mentioning to you if you're ever interested. Okay, so now we're going back to the Sofer of the Melech by the name of Shimshai. And it says the following, Mochek, he erased that section in the Divrei Hayomim book that tells the story, records the Mordechai saving the Melech. Okay, now we're going to get into the whole question of what is the difference between Sefer HaZichronos and Divrei Hayomim, the two names. Okay, and at the same time we want to answer the question, how is it possible for someone like Shimshai to erase in the presence of the king something which is written in the book? So he says the following. There were two Svarim. One Sefer was a great detailed record in a lengthy way with all the details of all the stories that were recorded. That's called Sefer Divrei Hayomim. Then there was another book which is called the Sefer HaZichronos, and that's a kind of mafteach. It's like an index, a very short recap of what was written in the Divrei Hayomim in a lengthy, detailed way. Now, on that particular night, they were reading in front of the Melech from the Sefer HaZichronos. And the Sefer HaZichronos, as we said before, is an abridged, a very abbreviated text, B'loshon Ketzara. Now, Im Hayah Shomea HaMelech Dover Shenir Lo Kiton B'dika, if the Melech heard something from this outline form in the Sefer HaZichronos that would catch his eye, meaning that would perk his curiosity, then he would tell the Makri that he should go back to the Divrei Hayomim book and read the Maisa Barichus with all its details. Now, where was Shimshai located? Hu Yoshav Batzad, he was sitting on the sidelines with the Sefer Divrei Hayomim. And therefore, Ahasuerus didn't have a direct view of him. He was a little bit of a distance. Maybe he was around the corner. Shoya Melch Mavakish Likro Lo Misham. When the king got to the point where he felt he wanted to go back to the original Divrei Hayomim, then at that point he would send a messenger to Shimshai to come and read from the Divrei Hayomim book. That gave Shimshai a certain, let's say, a time period, a certain short lapse of time, and he was able to be mochek from the Sefer that which he didn't want written. So maybe it said, again, I'm just adding my own flavor here, that maybe the Sefer HaZichronos said on such a day, there was a plotted rebellion against the king, and one of the members of the of the Chatzar Melech went ahead and he saved the king. But it didn't say any details. All the details and the names were recorded in the Sefer Divrei Hayomim. That gave Shimshai that little break in which he would play around with the text. So what happens now? Mordechai's name is not in the text. Gavriel is always considered that malach that saves Klal Yisrael. He's our divine, our celestial protector. He goes back kosev and he writes again that which was omitted by Shimshai. So the Mechika took place and then the Ksiva took place. Mechika by Shimshai and the Ksiva by a Malach. This is an unbelievable miracle that goes on such that it would be absolutely crystal clear that it was Mordechai. Omar Vasi, what do we derive from this? Doresh Rav Shila Ishkvar Tmarta Umak Sav Shalamata Shelizchuson Shel Yisrael Eino Nimchak. We're talking about something that's written here by human beings as a record book about Klal Yisrael, and the haters of Israel are not able to successfully erase it. Like, for example, the story of Mordechai, which Gavriel was absolutely certain that he would rewrite it in the case that it was erased. Is Ksav Shalomala? What about the absolute divine document up on high, which records all the maisim and all the good deeds of Klal Yisrael? How much more so Lo Kolshkein? For sure, it's protected, and no one is going to tamper with it and try to erase or successfully erase anything that's written about Klal Yisrael. He adds here a word in the name of the Marsha, and he says that Gavriel nimtza sham bekvius. Now, where is Gavriel's home, so to speak? Where is he located on a permanent basis? That's up in Shamayim. That's called Lamala. And in a case of a ksav betachtoni, down here on earth, then Gavriel has to come from on high and he has to go down here. But in case of the Ksav Lamala, he doesn't have to leave his place. He's up there guarding the Ksav. Now here there's a pirush of the Iyun Yaakov. The Iyun Yaakov, I think I mentioned in the past, I think his name was Chagiz, if I remember correctly. Anyway, he was the super commentary on the Agadata. He writes, Yesh Meforshim Sheksav Lamala Sha'omer Kanakavona L'Ksav Amodias Malosam Uskusam Shal Yisrael. So this Ksav up on high records all the great merits of Klal Yisrael, Vaschara Metzuplem, and the reward that's designated for them. V'eino Nimchak, and it can never be erased. Now, what's the significance of the fact that it can never be erased? He says the following, that we have a rule which is called Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chozer Bo Mitova She'omar Loses. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah.
In other words, how do we check out a Novi to know whether he's true or false? If he tells us that something good is going to happen and it doesn't happen, we know he's a false prophet. Because if he tells something bad is going to happen, maybe God had a second thought. But when it comes to good, is Nevuah Tova Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Chozer. Now I'm going to read the whole next pasuk. Vayomer HaMelech, Ma Naaseh Yikar Ugdula LeMordechai Al Zeh. Vayomu nare hamelech mishorsov lo nase imo davar. So the question is, if the pasuk would have been consistent, it would have said lo nase imo yikar ugdula. I mean, the melech was asking what yikar ugdula. He should have said we didn't give them yikar ugdula. But rather it says lo nase imo davar. And what does that mean? That what they had in mind was that, you know what, let's do something for him. It would have been enough if we do a davar. We don't have to do a yikar gedula. In other words, these were detractors of Mordechai. These were individuals who certainly didn't want to see Mordechai, you know, up on the horse over there. And therefore, they said, you know what, let's just do a davar for him. You don't have to give him yikar gedula. That much they didn't want to tolerate. Now, in the footnote here, he quotes a Rosh Yosef, which, if I'm not mistaken, is the same author as the Prima Gadim, and he writes, "Shamisharsim heishivu lo nase imo davar zeshel yikar ugdula, vel nase imo kvar davar ma." We haven't yet given him yikar ugdula, but we did already pay him back. You know, we gave him a davar ma, some insignificant something. But Eino Zakoi Liosim Mikach, he doesn't deserve anything more than that. And that's because they didn't harbor any great love for Mordechai, they harbored a great hate for Mordechai, and therefore they didn't want to give him any more reward than just the barest minimum. So they said, you know, that much we gave him already. And therefore, Mipnei Sin Asam. Oh, now, he adds another element to the equation. There's a certain lack of admiration for Mordechai, that's for sure. They don't want Yikar Gdula, but at the same time they harbor ill feelings towards Haman, as we saw earlier in the Agadita yesterday, that she, Esther, succeeded in engendering jealousy against Haman. Is lo tanu shemardechai kibel as kol scharo vishiru pesach laseis lo kovid nosa. So they admitted that we did something for Mordechai, but we didn't do enough. Let's give him a little bit more. Not Yikar Gdula, but a little bit more. And they were hoping, therefore, that Haman would suffer a little bit from this. Amar Rava, lo mipnei she'ohavim es Mordechai. I don't think that the reason why they agreed to give some element of recognition, of gratitude, is because they love Mordechai. Lo mipnei she'sonim es Haman. This is one of the most famous phrases that people use even to this day. There's lo mipnei avas Mordechai, but they saw the sinas Haman. You know, the cynics used to say that a lot of people coming on Aliyah not because they loved Israel, because they hated life in Chutz Lawrence. You know, waiting for the French Jews to come. They're coming. At one time, they were talking that there were 750,000 Jews in France. I don't know today if that number is still happening.
It's 200,000.
Yeah. At one point, it was a massive community, and that's all post-Holocaust. You know? These are not Ashkenazi French Jews. I mean, there's one shul I saw on Rehov Rashi, on Rue Rashi. No, I forgot the name of the street. Anyway, it's called the Rashi Shul. It's an Ashkenazi shul. It's like they're holding on like for dear life to the minhagim that they had before the war. You know, it's only one person says Kaddish. You know,
it's all from Moroccan and Tunisian Jews who came after.
That's it.
1948.
But I, you know what? A lot of French Jews are pretty wealthy, but I'm not jealous of them. I like the language, by the way, French. But I don't know a word of French, but it sounds good to me. But that's not the country I'd want to live in. I don't think so. Even though now today's news is a little bit more of a positive, they're accusing someone of anti-Semitism. But France is not a great place for us. All right. Anyway, the next pasuk says the following: how are we doing on the clock? Oh, we're doing okay. For Haman Balachatzar Beis Hamelch Achitzonah Leimar Lamelch Lisloses Mordechai Ala Eitz Asher Hechin Lo. Interesting. Hechin lo. Who's the lo over here? And it could have said Asher Hechin, you know, that he prepared. We understood. It says Litlos is Mordechai. It's obviously Hechin lo. Why do you have to add the word lo? Tono, we have a price that says lo Hechin, liatzmo Hechin. He prepared it for himself. Again, he didn't realize that what was coming out of his mouth, what he was saying, is a besora. He's foretelling the fact that he himself is going to be hung up on that very same tree. And a lot of the philosophy on Megillas Esther is about the about this nafohu kind of idea, that the very same tree that he prepared for Mordechai is the one that he gets hung up on. And then he says, the king says, "V'asei chen l'Mordechai haYehudi." You know, he tells him all the details. Hayoshev b'shar haMelech al tapel davar mikol shadibarta. So Achashverosh goes into great detail here to tell Haman what should be done to Mordechai. And lo istapik lomar lo, it wasn't enough for Achashverosh simply to say "V'asei chen l'Mordechai." He says, "Mishum shahaman he samim ve'asas atzmo ke'eno mevim klapim mi amurim hadvarim." Haman made himself like, in Yiddish we call domavat. You know, he tried to present the face as if he didn't understand what was going on. Amalei, so Haman says to Tachashresh, "Manu Mordechai, which Mordechai do you have in mind?" So now Achashverosh adds another word here, HaYehudi. You know, this sounds like the famous Chazal about Esa Ben Vayechid Hashem Ahavta. Every time I'm from, it's asking which son do you have in mind, right? So which person do you have in mind? Okay, Mordechai. Okay, which Mordechai? Mordechai Yehudi. There's no other Mordechai.
This one's for Sina.
So Haman still asks the question. Tuva Mordechai Ikabi Hudai. Mordechai is a very popular name amongst the Jewish people. Amalei. So now Ahasuerosh gets very, very specific. Hayoshev, which Yehudi is Hayoshev B'Shar HaMelech. Now at this point, Haman has no choice. This is the Mordechai that we're dealing with. And he cannot attribute it to any other possible person. So at this point, Haman realizes that he's going to have to give cover to Mordechai. Amalei. So he comes back and he puts forward the following argument. Sagile b'chad diskarta. That Mordechai, die im titing lo matana. Why do you have to give him such a great Yikaru Gdula? You know, just give him a basic, some sort of basic gift. Inami b'chad nara. Give him one river. You know, let him own one river. You know, you give him a cow to as a gift. Give him a river as a gift. You know, if he has a river, he can make a parnasa. You know, he can bring people back and forth over the river. You get himself a boat company. But while Bisho Big Day Malchus Larkiva Al Susa Melech, he's not fitting for that. Omer Lei Achashverosh responds to Haman, Ha Nami Havle. You know what? Whatever you suggested, giving him a gift or giving him a river to own and so forth, I'll give that to him too. But in addition to what all your suggestions are, it's absolutely necessary for you to be Malbish Haman, I'm sorry, Mordechai, the big day Malchus, Urechiv al Sus. All that you have to do, Al Tapel Davar Mikol Asher Divarta. Everything that you suggested, that's what you have to give. And here we have a comment of the Marsha. Haman Chazer Bogak Bimasha Omer Shakiveu Bilvush Malchus, Bechol Rechova Seir Vitoan, Shalom Mordechai Maspik Shakiveu Bilvush Malchus. Why do we have to go throughout the entire city? We'll take him through a certain neighborhood, a certain village. We'll take him over a bridge or something like that. And Achashverosh says no. Al tapel. And these are extra words. He already said, Asei chen. Do this for Mordechai HaYehudi HaYoshim Shama. So why do you have to add the words Al tefen? Al tapel, excuse me. And the answer is, HaMelech Omer Shalom Yapil Dover V'Yitein Lo Es HaKol. The Marsha says, give him everything. All that you suggested plus what I suggested. Now he has a comment here from the Sifsei Chachamim. Haman claimed that this is not a covet for the Malchus, that a poor person who's wearing sack V'Efer, right? He's wearing his sackcloth. He should now wear Big Day HaMelech. He's going to, that same person, he's going to, like a hobo, he's like a homeless person, and now you're going to dress him up in Big Day HaMelech, in the Levush HaMelech. It's not worth giving him all the possessions so that he'd be appropriate for him to wear the big day malchus. So Achashverosh answers, give him whatever you want. Give him a village, give him a river, give him whatever you want to make him rich, so that now he can wear the big day malchus and he can receive this cover. And again, if we summarize what motivates Achashverosh here, again, it's not the love for Mordechai as much as he wants to make it clear to he's such a paranoid king, he's got to make sure that the loyalty is there. You remember we had a whole discussion about whether or not he should invite the local people in Shushan first to the party, or like the, you know, the, and it's all about the possibility of revolution. That's the Malbim's whole approach to Megillas Esther, is that the whole story on one level, meaning on the Pshuto Shel Mikra, is all focused on this paranoia of the king.
Interesting. It reminds me of Machiavelli, the prince. There's all these lessons as to, you know, how you have to constantly be calculating with everyone around you to stay in power.
Right.
It looks like we've got these lessons here coming.
Now, I've also said, before we leave, I just want to share with you something I saw here in the Yalkut HaBi'urim. You remember that when Esther stands in one place before she goes into the chatzar of the melech, the Shekhinah is mistalik, and she feels like Keli Keli Lomas of Tani, she's left in the lurch. Yeah, the Shekhinah has left her, has departed. And she then says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, am I guilty? I'm not doing anything b'mezid. I'm only doing this for the sake of Klal Yisrael, and you shouldn't judge me in such a negative way. The Varshai asks the following question. Maduak Tolsa Esilik HaShekhinah Biglal Zeh, meaning she's justifying the fact that she takes the initiative to go into Achashverosh and have this intimate relationship with him, and then she says Kasher Avodati Avodati, she'll no longer be able to resume her relationship with Mordechai, and she thinks that maybe God is holding her accountable for the fact that she's initiating this intimacy with Achashverosh. So the Marsha is perturbed by this. He says, Hare Mashma, the simple pshat is, she, why was the Siluk Shekhinah? Biglal she ba'a lebeis hatzlamin. She was entering a place where there were idols, and therefore nistalka b'mena Shekhinah. Again, we said yesterday that there were two interpretations. The Marsha is assuming literally that this was a beis hatzlamin, that in order to get access, you know, it's like if you want to leave the Vatican, you have to go through the Sistine Chapel. There's no other way out, you know. So in order to get to Achashverosh, you have to go through the beis hatzlamin. You know, it's in like in Las Vegas. You want to get out of a hotel, you have to put a couple of coins in the slot machines. You know what I'm saying? So he says the following. Pirush HaMarsha, therefore the Marsha says the following. Kevin sheigia Esther lebeis hatzlamim, shu beis avodazor v'nistalka v'mena Shekhinah, mishum d'chsiv, the pasuk says, al tiftu el ha'ililim. So we thought that the reason why Esther was blaming herself and trying to therefore justify herself in front of God and invoke divine compassion is because she went into Achashverosh to have this relationship. No, 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 says the Marsha. She understood that since the pasuk says al tifnu el ha'ililim, that you're not allowed to go even near the idols. In other words, stay away from a place of avodah zarah. That's the whole issue today of going into a church. Is tana Esther v'yomishlo nichnasa kan mirtzona, that even though she has to go into this church, so to speak, right, this idolatrous temple, it's not because she wants the chas v'shalom enjoy the benefit of idolatry. Ella he anusa. She has no choice. She has no way of getting to the king. He's not accessible. And therefore she claimed, this is the lovedness of Esther, ein kan isu shal al tifnu. The word tifnu means that you deliberately look towards the Avodah Zarah and you want to go in there. She came lo hoysel derech acheres lovo el ha-melech. That's what she's claiming. So basically the Marsha completely cuts off the relationship between this Agadat and the previous Agadat about Kasher Avodati Avodati. We thought that the reason why she was saying to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm an anus and I'm not amazing, is because of her quote unquote adulterous relationship with Achashverosh. No, it had nothing to do with that. It's all because of her going into a Beis Hatzlamim. That's why the Shechina was nostalgic, and she said, I don't deserve that. Now, again, who am I to question the Marsha? But what bothers me about this Marsha is that if the Shechina doesn't go into Beis Hatzlamim, the Shechina is not going to go into the Beis Hatzlamim, period. I don't care why you have to go into the Beis Hatzlamim. You know, if we're dealing with judgment of whether you're allowed, it's a violation of Al Tifnu Al Elim, it's not a violation of Al Tifnu, that's one thing. But that's not the issue here. The Siluk Shechina is a result of what we call the Cheft of Avodah Zarah, the Beis Hatzlamim. So that question I still have on the Marsha. But also have a great day, and thank you so much.